It's one of those things that once you see it, you can't unsee it. I'm talking about those shiny panels and symbols of progress in a slow march across the landscape. Kind of makes my heart sink. And I feel really conflicted and cautious about how to unpack this one. But I'm going to do it anyway. So hey everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of If I Rule the World, Tough Gig. Yes, there's a lot going on in the world that I don't like, but the ticket I pull today is a deep dive into one very specific aspect of a very specific technology in one very specific location, but with a universal lesson that I believe can be applied absolutely anywhere. And all of this plays out in a very unlikely stage, the quiet corridors of a local authority planning department and a wildlife charity. I came across this story while writing my monthly opinion piece for BBC Wildlife magazine. And yes, I know opinions are like assholes. Everyone's got one, but that's what they asked me to do. So that's what I did. I decided to stick my neck out and ask the question, why do so many solar farms look an awful lot like sterile monocultures? At least to me, they do. Look, I've been banging on about the climate crisis ever since the days we used to call it global warming. So I feel like a traitor to the cause. I feel like I'm scoring an own goal here. I feel like I'm handing the other side an easy win on a silver platter with icing and a cherry on top, and I can hear them now. Those eco-fascist libtards are never happy, and you know what? I'm not. I'm never happy, because if I rule the world, we'd all know what it feels like to rest each day, lay down on the grass, stare into the blue sky, and have enough time to imagine what infinity looks like. But I know that's not going to happen anytime soon. So I handed in my draft copy to the editor, and she parried. She immediately sent back several research papers, and I had to concede that, at least in theory, solar farms can be good for wildlife and nature. But the question remains, does this really happen in practice? So I set out to find some answers, and at least here in the UK, all roads seemed to lead to Mike Webb at Gwent Wildlife Trust. Mike studied ecology but went on to qualify as a chartered town planner. He's a member of the Royal Town Planning Institute. He's had over 15 years experience working in local planning authorities, having sat on sounding boards and steering groups, and 23 years experience as a planner working with environmental charities. He's been working with Gwent Wildlife Trust since 2019, where, as the planning and policy manager, he's been part of the campaign team challenging several developments, including a number of solar power stations, on a particularly nature-rich habitat in South Wales known as the Gwent Levels. One large 75-megawatt solar power station was built during the pandemic, consisting of 250,000 solar panels and covering 350 acres, three parcels of which are in the Gwent Levels. And yes, it was a blow to the campaign, but as we're about to hear from Mike, as galling as that was, it was absolutely crucial that they stick around to see what happened next.
I grew up in my very early years in rural North Wales, and then my family moved to Cardiff, to the capital city. So I think moving from that rural to urban context gave me a feeling of loss, I think, and of fragility and of the temporary nature of the beauty of the natural world that we can sometimes take for granted. I think in terms of how I got to where I am, I think it's also important for me anyway, to bear in mind that all these things have a political context as well, Gillian. And I think I grew up in quite a political family. My grandfather was a coal miner in the South Wales Valleys, and he was part of the Jarrow marches. He walked from the Rhondda Valley in South Wales to London in the 1930s as part of a political demonstration. Well, that's what it would be called now. So I grew up in a political family where politics was something that was talked about freely. And I think combining those two feelings of the absolute right of nature to exist of itself, and the fact that nature has an intrinsic value which can't be captured by the marketization of nature, which is always a temptation for policymakers. So I think it's a mixture of my own political background and my own backstory, really, Gillian.
So you describe yourself as coming from a political family. You grew up at a time of huge change. What I'm interested in, you know, was it about, well, I need to help people out, because you must have seen a lot of hardship as Wales went through this massive transition? Or was it, well, I'm going to just concentrate on nature? Or is it a mixture of two? How do you see it?
I think I was probably the first generation that wanted to pursue a mixture of the two, I think, Gillian. Yeah, when I applied for university in 1979, you were allowed, I think, 4 or 5 choices of universities to go through. At that time, I think there were only 5 universities in the whole of the UK that offered ecology as a subject. So I suppose the appreciation of ecology in its wider sense was something that is still in its infancy, I think. And I think I was probably in the first generation that mixed environment and politics. I think before that, environment was about wildlife. It was about species, charismatic species, in a sort of policy vacuum. And I think it is important to not shy away from the fact that these are political and policy issues that need to be followed through to the sort of strategic level.
So you are now the planning manager at Gwent Wildlife Trust. Have you gone from ecology into sort of planning and local authorities, or, you know, what did that look like from going into uni?
Yeah, I started off in the NGO sector, and I kind of moved sideways into the local government sector as a local government planner. And yeah, so I did 13 years as a local government planner. So I think that's where I've gained an appreciation of how policy formulation and how governmental policy formulation works and more importantly, doesn't work. I then moved into the NGO sector. So I'm 17 or 18 years now in the NGO sector.
You had that stint in the planning office, I guess, as your planning officer, right? It's kind of weird because for me, like, I don't know why this is. It's a little bit like going through customs. Like whenever I hear the word like planning officer, it makes me feel instantly guilty. Like I don't even own my own house. I've never done any work, you know. So I don't know. There is a little bit of a, I don't know. It sort of feels a little bit like, it, you know, you don't want to get involved with a planning officer unless you absolutely have to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right, Julian. I think. Yeah, I mean, planning sounds a terribly boring subject, but obviously in today's world, it's very important. So it's planning has become great, or it's had greatness thrust upon it. I think that's how I would put it. In the old days, planning was seen as a sort of land traffic warden. So a planner was somebody who walked around looking at buildings and saying, oh, no, you're not allowed to have that there. Go on, get rid of it, take it down and go away and don't come back. It's come from that sort of restrictive approach to more of a creative approach, trying to facilitate sustainable development. So I think we are moving in the planning system very, very, very slowly at a sort of glacial pace towards a more sustainable planning system. Obviously, there's a massive time lag of decades. You know, the senior planners that you see in local authorities now will have gone to university in, let's say, the mid-70s, when ecology wasn't a thing. Sustainable development wasn't a thing. Nobody knew about it. And it was really about building stuff, building houses, building offices, building roads. It was about pouring concrete and getting stuff built. So the challenge, I think, now for the new generation of planners coming through is to kind of, let's turn around that supertanker. You know, let's look about creating sustainable places. And if that involves saying no to unsustainable development, well, let's say no.
That's a great segue into the reason why we even had a conversation in the first place. The reason why we're even here is there's a very specific campaign going on at the moment with Gwent Wildlife Trust. Tell me about that.
The Gwent Levels is an absolutely marvellous place. It's a very mysterious place. If you think of Wales, people from outside Wales think of the stunning mountains of Snowdonia, the beautiful coast of Pembrokeshire. So Wales is mountains and coast, isn't it? Well, no, There's more to it than that. So Wales have this beautiful, mysterious flatlands in the southeast corner of Wales, which are a sort of liminal habitat. It's a habitat that's been created over millennia due to the interaction of human activity and natural forces. It's teeming with wildlife. It's a fragile and complex set of habitats at a landscape scale. But in a strange sort of Alice in Wonderland sort of way, Gillian, it's ended up being the target of built development. Now, there are various reasons for that, but it is an SSSI, a site of special scientific interest. So it's designated at the UK level, statutorily designated for its nature conservation interest. And we find it extraordinary that such a beautiful, rich, diverse, fragile, complex area has become the Klondike for developers. So our campaign, many people will have heard of a proposed new motorway, the M4 relief road. That was a campaign that I and others were involved with over a number of years. Again, going back to this sort of radical Welsh tradition of progressive politics, that highway proposal was turned down by the current First Minister, Mark Drakeford, on environmental and other grounds. We all breathed a sigh of relief, but of course, things never stand still, do they? And now we're in an extraordinary position where we are now threatened with another wave of development. Some of it is built developments, hard built developments, and sadly, a lot of it is solar farms or solar energy development. We decided that we're trying to fight all of these solar projects. So there's a wave of solar projects coming through on the Gwent Levels SSSI. And I'll repeat that if you think you didn't hear me correctly, Gillian. These are developments on top of a wetland SSSI. So we've been fighting these schemes. The Gwent Wildlife Trust has been fighting these schemes for years and years. And finally, we decided, do you know what? We've got to have a red line in the sand. We've got to stop this type of development at the strategic level. We've got to stop it definitively. Otherwise, we and the communities of the levels are going to be fighting individual projects for all eternity. So we decided we and the communities of the Gwent Levels, because the Gwent Levels is a place for people and communities as well as being for wildlife. We and the communities and some of the other NGOs have started a campaign to bring about a halt, a moratorium on major built developments on the Gwent Levels SSSI. So we're in the middle of that campaign now.
When I got in touch with you initially, I was writing an article for BBC Wildlife Magazine, and it was based on what I would say is sort of anecdotal, casual observer, me on a train, whizzing past solar farms, solar parks, and noting, and it's almost become a little bit of an obsession whenever I'm traveling cross country somewhere. I really look carefully to see if I can see any kind of plant diversity growing in a solar farm. And I've just, like I said, I'm a kind of sample size of one, and you know, my journey will be limited to where the places I like to go to or need to go to. But I would say that it struck me as interesting that it looked like a really sterile monoculture. Now, this is like, oh my goodness, this is, you know, this is where I've got to be so careful how we proceed, because what I'm trying not to do is say solar farms and solar parks are bad. No, what I'm trying to say is it requires a little bit more scrutiny. So in writing and wanting to research this column that I was writing, I was put in touch with you, and pretty much all roads seem to lead to Mike Webb as the person to speak to about what are the impacts, because it seemed to me that when I looked online, there was plenty of research and articles and kind of literature to support the idea that solar farms can be really beneficial to biodiversity, yet that's not what I was seeing. And you were able to help me out there a bit. So just talk a little bit specifically about what you've learned about solar parks, solar farms in trying to campaign for the protection of the Gwent Levels SSSIs?
Yeah, sure, Julia. Well, it's sad, isn't it? It's sad as an environmentalist, as a lifelong environmentalist. It's sad that we find ourselves where we are. We didn't want to be here. We didn't want to be campaigning against renewable energy. It goes against our most deeply held beliefs and feelings.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it goes against what we would like to be doing. But as you say, we can't run away from the fact that certainly in respect of the Gwent Levels SSSI, there is undoubtedly adverse impacts arising from solar farm developments. Now, that's not to say that we object to all solar farms throughout Gwent. There are solar farms on improved grassland within Gwent that we haven't objected to. So we do see solar as being an important part of the renewable energy mix. So the Welsh government has got very aspirational targets for net zero. And we understand that. We get that. And we get the sense of desperation. You've only got to see our burning planet on our TV screens to realise that we are in a climate crisis. But we're also in a nature crisis as well. And you can't separate those two out. You know, the Welsh government have declared a conjoined climate and nature crisis. We can't save nature by destroying nature. So we are in this sad and Alice in Wonderland situation where we're having to object to solar farms on the Gwent Levels SSSI. Now, developers will tell you that not to worry because there'll be plenty of mitigation measures, you know, that will mean that things will be okay.
So, sorry, mitigation measures with respect to what?
So, for example, they'll say that we won't carry out any physical construction works within, let's say, 5 metres of the wetland features of the SSSI, the drainage ditches that contain this myriad of invertebrates and aquatic plants. They'll say we'll only carry out construction at certain times of the year. We'll only carry out maintenance in certain times of the year. But these things, in real life, these things don't actually happen. There is actually one constructed solar farm on the Gwent Levels. And we've been looking into the documentation, you know, relating to what's called post-construction monitoring. So that's a type of monitoring, ecological monitoring, that developers are supposed to do after they've constructed a solar farm or any other type of development. They're meant to go back to the development site, monitor things like water quality, because that's really important for the Gwent Levels, because it's a water environment. We've gone back through some of that documentation, which is pretty techy. It's pretty obscure. It's hidden in the bowels of the planning department. But we've gone back through some of that as much as we can. And what we discovered has shocked us, really. I think it's human nature to, if you lose a battle, then you don't tend to want to go back over the site which has been destroyed to look at the documentation, because it's a bit kind of soul destroying, isn't it, really? You know, the tendency is to think, and to feel very deflated and just to want to move on to something else, move on to the next battle. But we've had to try and kind of resist that temptation. We've had to force ourselves to go back over some of this documentation. And as I say, we've found highly elevated levels of pollutants in the water features inside and downstream of a solar farm. So just for example, if you think of silt, which is a classic pollutant of watercourses, we found one site where there was 7.4 million micrograms per litre of silt in the water features of the SSSI, compared with 0.53 million micrograms before the site was constructed.
So what would have caused that?
Yeah, so that could have been caused by the disturbance of the ground by physical construction, probably. It might have been caused by grazing animals near the inside or near the development site. So to give another example, total petroleum hydrocarbons, 230 micrograms per litre inside the development site Before construction, that was less than 10 micrograms per litre. So that's a 23-fold increase in this hydrocarbon-based pollutant. That could be things like pollution from vehicles, construction vehicles accessing the site. It could be subsoil disturbed by the development construction. It's hard to visualise, Gillian, the sort of the scale of these things. You know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of panels, and there'll be cable trenches, there'll be culverts, there'll be bridges, there'll be soil storage areas, there'll be plant and machinery storage areas, there'll be battery storage. And when I talk about batteries, I'm not talking about, you know, your little AA batteries. I'm talking about batteries the size of articulated lorries. Mm. These are absolutely massive structures. And obviously they contain a lot of heavy metals, hundreds of thousands of steel structures pile driven into the SSSI. There's a question mark over whether metal pollution will manifest itself. And there are some studies in America from solar farms showing that heavy metals can move sideways in the soil from solar farms. So the picture I'm painting is pretty bleak, to be honest, Gillian.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's bleak, and it's almost like, at least for me, it feels like, I'm like, oh God, this was never the vision. I've now been working in natural history, filmmaking, and in my own very ineffectual way, I think, trying to make a difference.
Oh, not
and
at all.
All of a sudden, I'm thinking, like, how did we end up like this, where the kind of almost the shining symbols of renewables and what we're going to do to save the planet, inverted commas, produces all this waste. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise, but what do you think? I mean, what do you think the solution is?
I think it's a lack of kind of strategic thinking. Renewables, good, but not everywhere. Sometimes people say to me, oh, but why are you protesting against renewable energy? And I say, well, do you think hospitals are a good idea? And they say, yes. So I say, well, would you build a hospital on the top of Snowdon? And they say, well, no, obviously I wouldn't. No, of course I wouldn't. And you say, hang on a minute, you just said that hospitals were a good idea. So it's trying to get across this idea of right idea, wrong place. And I think the solution ultimately is taking a strategic approach to renewable energy and identifying the zones within Wales where renewable energy sites could have zero or minimal adverse impacts.
So, I mean, obviously that's within Wales, but within the UK, rest of the world, I mean, where would you say is a suitable site for a solar farm?
As you said earlier on, you've seen the glossy brochures from developers pointing to a net gain for biodiversity from solar farms. And those sites are usually sites of improved grassland, improved agricultural land, which has very little biodiversity value. So I think I would say, look at places like that. Look at roofs of buildings, look at motorway central reservations, look at car parks, look at individual housing. So yes, we need to look everywhere we can before we start building huge solar farms on fragile and complex wetland ecosystems. And it needs a bit of political courage, I think.
Yeah.
It needs courage, and it needs a strategic approach rather than what I would call a scattergun approach in the UK. We need courage. We need political courage. We need a strategic approach. And we need a clear vision as to how we are going to hit our renewable energy targets without destroying the environment that we're trying to preserve. And I often think, you know, we also need to remember that natural systems can be carbon sinks and carbon sequestration systems as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, wetlands is one of the most efficient carbon sequestration method we have. It's a nature-based solution. Mm-hmm. And I often think to put a solar farm on a wetland ecosystem in terms of climate and nature emergencies, it's a bit like saying, oh, I've got a headache. Oh dear. Oh, well, I think what I'll do is I'll cut my head off with a rusty chainsaw. It's that level.
Fix the headache.
Yeah, that's fix the headache. Yeah.
Last headache you'll ever have.
That's right. Yeah. So that's, we need to get away from this kind of short-term thinking and kind of sort of jobs versus the environment or the environment versus nature. We need to think imaginatively in pursuit of sustainable development.
I feel like you've got this very unique position where you've been a planning officer, but you did ecology. You're sort of, the sum total of your experiences means you can see things from both sides. So let's say I'm a developer, someone with a bit of cash to burn, and I'm like, where can I invest this cash? Solar farms, great. I'm doing something for the environment. I'm doing my bit for the planet, and I'm going to make some money out of it as well. Like, what would... Why would I choose, a sort of biodiverse wetland over building solar panels on existing infrastructure? So, say, a factory with lots of roof available. Like, what are the hurdles for me as a developer?
I think it's probably cost. It's profit margins. I think that's what it comes down to. It's cheaper to build a solar farm on flat land, on green land. The Gwent Levels has a legacy of steel working. Again, this is part of our industrial heritage in Wales. So we have surplus electricity grid capacity in Southeast Wales. That is the reason that developers are diving into that part of Wales. But I would say that's not good enough, is it? We don't have to dive into the most biodiverse wetland, the largest coastal and floodplain grazing marsh in Wales. Look elsewhere, and I would say be creative and look to tick all of those boxes, the biodiversity and the nature box, as well as the climate change box.
But is there a danger, and I hate to say this, that it's sort of a little bit sort of NIMBYism going on here, not in my backyard, which is anywhere else but here? Because if you're saying that without proper monitoring and without proper incentives for operators, so once the solar farm is constructed and once all the machinery is up and running and all the campaigners have left and everyone's stopped paying attention, that there's capacity for these farms to produce pollutants, leach pollutants into the environment. Like, surely nowhere should have a solar farm until we fix that problem.
I think what's special about Gwent Level, Gillian, is that It's an ecosystem that's wholly reliant on a very high water quality, and because it's a wetland, it's a coastal and floodplain grazing marsh. Those adverse impacts wouldn't manifest themselves to anything like this degree if it was on improved grassland, and certainly if it was on the roofs of existing buildings or even many areas of brownfield land. And it's important to remember that we haven't objected to solar farms within Gwent, because Gwent obviously covers a much larger area than the Gwent Levels. So no, I think I'd reject the NIMBY the NIMBY charge. It depends what your backyard is. If your backyard is a UK nationally designated site for nature conservation, which is completely reliant on a very high water quality for its wildlife, then maybe I am a NIMBY, but it depends what your backyard is and where it is.
Triodos Bank is the exclusive sponsor for If I Rule the World, and I can honestly say they make my job of doing this mid-roll shout-out really easy. Here's why. Triodos has been blazing a trail for the financial sector in ethical and sustainable banking for over 40 years, and they believe in being totally upfront and transparent with what they do and what they don't do with their money. So let's start with what they don't do. They don't lend to arms companies or fossil fuel projects. They focus instead on financing sustainable businesses and charities, working on nature regeneration, community projects, and renewables. But as we're learning in this episode, just because we like the sound of renewable and green energy doesn't mean it's above scrutiny. Projects of the size that Triodos finances first jump through the UK government's hoops on environmental impact assessment. Triodos then runs the whole thing through yet more loops, its in-house legal and technical due diligence, before reaching its own opinion about the seriousness and quality of the project's plans for biodiversity as well as social enhancement. But here's the kicker. Triodos only finances new renewable projects on low-grade land, avoiding the sort of situation that we're hearing about in this episode. So, on that note, let's get back to it. In my view, I think either way, we should be doing more to prevent, to improve the biodiversity, irrespective of where that sort of baseline is. How do we genuinely create the kind of the glossy image that we're sold? And when I say we, I think for most people, the at least this is how I felt until I started looking, renewable and seeing solar farms go up seemed like a really great idea. And I felt this was progress. We were like, finally, somebody's listening and we're making a difference here. But it, like you say, it is really quite soul destroying and a bit crushing to discover that, okay, there are negative impacts as well. So what do we do?
Well, all four of the UK's planning systems in one way or another have a requirement now for a biodiversity net gain. Mm-hmm. The different countries run that in different ways, but they all have that concept now embedded, theoretically embedded in their planning systems. So that means that it should be possible to refuse planning permission if the net gain proposals of a developer are not, either they're not there or they're not sufficient. So we should be able to do that. We have the means at our disposal to do that. And bearing in mind that these projects are highly, highly profitable, and they produce a guaranteed income for the developer and the landowner, it's not beyond human intelligence to develop a system where biodiversity gains can be got both associated with the development and also what planners call off-site. So where resources can be devoted in addition to on-site, but to promote biodiversity away from the solar farm. Mm-hmm. One thing I'd like to see personally is what I would call a nature recovery levy. So I feel that all developers, especially renewable energy developers, should pay a small percentage of the cost of the scheme into a fund which collectively could be deployed to carry out nature recovery on a landscape scale. I think that's the way forward, is to, like you say, to bring about some meaningful biodiversity enhancement, not the odd bird box or the odd tree planting scheme or the odd bat box, but actually to do something that's of the same scale and magnitude of the development proposal itself, Julian. We need to be more clear, I think, that, you know, there are some locations where development is simply not acceptable. And we need to be stronger and braver and more courageous in promoting that concept. We do have some of the tools in the toolbox. So theoretically, a development proposal must be, quote, wholly exceptional, unquote, to be allowed on an SSSI. But they're like the sleeping clauses of the planning system. They're there, but they're not used very much.
So it's the ability to roll out that sort of development at scale is what makes this wholly exceptional. Am I getting that right?
That's what the developer would argue, I'm sure, yes. And, mm-hmm. You know, when you talk at scale, these projects are absolutely enormous. You know,
paint a picture for me.
I was about to say, I can't paint a picture for you. They are absolutely enormous. You know, we've heard about one completely on the SSSI, which is 400 hectares in extent. That's 400. In Wales, we use rugby pitches, but mm-hmm. in England, you might use football pitches. 400 football pitches. It's as far as the eye can see. You can't imagine the scale of these projects. But there's hundreds of thousands of hectares mm-hmm. outside SSSIs in Wales where solar farms can and are and will be developed.
Because, I mean, you know, as we're saying all this, I'm like, oh, gosh, I know what this is going to do. This is literally handing on a platter counter arguments to energy transitions, to all the kind of mitigation, environmental mitigation we'd like to see. So I almost feel like I'm doing the whole movement a disservice by pointing this out. But I also feel like I can't ignore it, because it's so easy otherwise to just assume that every time you see a solar farm go up, that's progress. Is it that we just need to be monitoring these sites more closely post-construction? Do you think that is the solution or one solution?
I think it's human nature that once a scheme's constructed, people tend to think, okay, well, it's doing its own thing now, so we'll just let it get on with it and happy days. So, yeah, the post-construction side of things is a bit the sort of Cinderella of the planning system. People tend to forget about it and the documents get buried in the bowels of the planning departments. Some of the documents which we've seen, I can guarantee you, I'm probably one of only 15 to 20 people on this planet that have seen some of the documentation that we're talking about, because they're produced as a requirement and they're then dutifully filed and nothing much happens with them. So I don't think we're doing the environmental movement a disservice, because we recognise that we do need to deploy renewable energy at scale. But there are more clever ways of doing that. In our sort of understandable dash for renewable energy, somehow in that dash, we've missed a trick. You know, we've lost a grip on, you know, what could go wrong. And we need to be a bit more clever, a bit more calm and a bit more cool about how we deliver these things.
That sounds like a great, a really good, clear set of, not necessarily instructions, but I guess a mindset in how to move forward with this. I think that's possibly the danger, well, maybe the downside of operating in the context of a climate and nature crisis and emergency and wanting everyone to panic so that people act. But
yes,
you need a little bit of both, it sounds like. You need that sort of sense of urgency. But like any good first responder will know, in a crisis, you walk, you take your time. You slow things down so that you can think more clearly. I think that sort of almost helps to almost embody how we need to be responding to these massive challenges.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. You know, I think there's been some, you know, I gather there's been some work on the psychology of the climate emergency. And there's been some work done, especially amongst young people, about climate anxiety and climate hopelessness. And I think there's a danger of framing these things in such a way that we throw up our hands in despair and give up. There's also a danger at the other end of the spectrum of, rolling out these sparkling brand new technologies, which makes people feel, oh, it'll be fine. The boffins will sort it out. The scientists will sort it out. So we need to find somewhere in the middle of that spectrum, I think, where, yes, there's a sense of urgency, but there isn't a sense of despondency, and there isn't a sense of panic, and there isn't a sense of let's do anything we can, anywhere we can, whenever we can, and let's do it by yesterday. Otherwise, it'll be hopeless. So it's where you pitch yourself on that spectrum of, you know, utter despondency to complacency. And I think we should pitch ourselves somewhere in the middle. And I like your analogy of the, you know, the walking slow responder. I think that's, and triage. I think those are really good concepts to use in the concept of the climate and nature emergencies.
I mean, is that really where the kind of, as they say, the rubber hits the road, where, you know, the legislation, the kind of, I hate to use the word boring, but it's not glamorous, I don't think.
Yeah. I'll tell you, to a young person starting out in their career in environmental matters, I think environmental policy is really, really important, because if we can get the policy and the legislation right, the right results will flow from that. Otherwise, we're going to be fighting individual battles for all eternity and we're not going to win any wars. So, as you say, it's not rock and roll, but it is something that's really important that the younger generation and young people starting their careers get involved with. Things like post-construction monitoring is very much a sort of Cinderella of the planning system, because it's boring and there's a feeling that you're locking the stable door after the horse is bolted. But I think environmental policy, strategic working, strategic thinking, advocacy at all the political levels, are things that are really, really important. And I think they'll become more important as we move forward.
To me, I feel like I would know what you would say if I asked you, if you rule the world, Mike, what would you do in terms of planning? But is there bigger picture stuff that you would tackle if you were king for the day, king of the world?
I think if I was king of the world, or at least I'd be happy to be king of Wales to start off with.
Okay.
Can I start off with Wales? And
let's
then
tackle Wales first. Go on.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think a robust statutory environmental body, which is fit for purpose, is something that I'd create on day one of my rule. We have all the four countries have statutory advisors on nature conservation interests. They are horribly underfunded. We are aware that morale is very low amongst their staff. We're aware of an enormous turnover in staff. We're aware that they have become a political football and a political punchbag for people who don't see the things the way we do. We're aware that they, to an extent, they have some conflicting elements within their own mission statements. So I think if I was King of Wales for the day, I think I would say, okay, let's reset our environment protection governmental body, and let's make it a lot more fit for purpose. Let's make it more robust, more confident, properly funded. Let's increase its independence from government at all levels, and let's make it resistant to development pressure. You know, let's move forward on that type of environmental safeguarding and environmental governance.
I'm always surprised whenever I ask a guest this question that I don't get some, like, the things I would ban if I was in charge, like the list goes on. It'd be much more of a dictatorship than anything else. But
it'd be a benign dictatorship, for you, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I say definitely. Maybe I should keep those thoughts myself. I mean, seriously, though, I guess if you rule the whole world, what would you do?
There's a kind of temptation to view the fight against climate change through the wrong end of the pipe, if you like, view it through the sort of emissions end of the pipe. And we do become fixated with how many megawatts of renewable energy generational capacity we can produce. And yeah, there is that assumption that techno fixes will eventually create enough energy for all our wants and needs. So yes, I think I'm definitely with you on that one. I think we can do a lot more on reducing energy demand. And we can do that in ways that are not necessarily that obvious, like the deployment of built development, housing, for example. We can make sure that housing is, the spatial distribution of housing is more sustainable, that it's nearer to transport hubs. We can make it easier for people to access public transport and leave their cars at home. Yeah, we can do a lot of, again, not very sexy things, but a lot of things which reduce our need for energy at source rather than over-concentrating on a sort of end-of-pipe solution. Mm. So I think on a global scale, again, you know, it's brought into even more sort of stark reality when you think of the terrible struggles that people have had in Latin America, for example, opposing enormous hydropower schemes. People have lost their lives resisting those schemes. One of my heroes is Berta Cáceres, who's a Honduran environmental campaigner who lost her life campaigning against hydro schemes in Honduras. There's a struggle going on in the developing world, in the global south, which is a stark struggle. People are losing their lives protesting against damaging schemes which are nominally renewable. So yeah, I'm definitely with you on reducing energy demand at source, as well as generating renewable energy in a sustainable way.
And just to, I guess, almost bring us back into what I guess you and I is about, which is the natural world. What is your go-to? Where is your go-to? How do you reconnect with nature?
You know, Gwent Wildlife Trust have a string of absolutely wonderful nature reserves. So yeah, I've got a number of go-to places where I want to lift my head up from the sort of boring techie planning documents. So breeding lapwings are an iconic species that I've loved for years. And they have this beautiful display flight. They're a loosely colonial breeding species. So yeah, if you want that sort of wow moment, it's the experiencing the breeding display flight of lapwings and that feeling of they don't need me, they don't need humans to exist, and they're part of a longer and larger flow of nature. They're not a computer game. They're not in an art gallery. They're not a newspaper. They're not a book. They are themselves. You know, they have intrinsic value. They have a right to exist and to be themselves of themselves.
I really felt for Mike and any nature-bored environmentalist caught in this conundrum. Mike is such a measured speaker, but I could really sense his exasperation when he said, they don't want to be campaigning against renewable energy. But as he says, this is down to the right development for the right place. Because even though the green energy transition is something to be supported, we'd be fools not to demand more scrutiny and not to keep at least a small corner of our minds open to the possibility that, at least in some cases, people are going to cut corners. The biggest takeaway for me, though, is what I'm calling the loser syndrome. At precisely the moment when the battle is lost and the temptation to walk away is strong, remaining at the scene, no matter how crushing or soul-destroying, as Mike called it, it's absolutely crucial to stick around to see what happens next, to gather data, do the learning, get more strategic, and come back stronger and smarter for the next fight. For me, this is the gem, tucked away in what at face value seems like a very niche story. And it's really energizing. Not that euphoric, punch-the-air energizing, but marathon energy. And of course, it is a marathon. Thank you to all of you who've been getting in touch with your feedback on episodes and for sharing your plans for world domination. You know what? I'm stunned because so far, everyone's being really sensible. Actually, I should say you're really caring, a really compassionate bunch. There have been several people writing in with a clear belief that we've got to start young, with lots of ideas around education, investing in early years education, especially nourishment care, all that good stuff. But I really like Dave Barker's proposal. Hi, Dave, in Essex. Dave talks about enshrining earth education within all education systems, businesses, and economies so that we really embed a central organizing truth that we are part of the web of life. I love that. Others are calling for a wealth tax, which I've got to be honest, the first time I started hearing about wealth tax, I was thinking income tax. Of course, the two things are entirely different. And this is something that former interest rate trader turned equality campaigner Gary Stevenson is on an absolute mission about. I'm going to be trying to get him onto If I Rule the World, onto the podcast. He's got a book coming out in the next month, and fuck it, I'm going to give it a plug whether I get him on the podcast or not, because you know what? This isn't about me. This is about all of us. So the book is called Trading Game, published by Penguin, so keep an eye out for it. It's going to be coming out in the next few weeks. Check out his YouTube channel as well. It's called Gary's Economics. It's absolutely blowing up at the moment. And if you want to hear him on this podcast, on If I Rule the World, then please share. Share, share, and share away, because you know how this game goes. More listens, more shares, more follows, more likes means more clout to get guests like Gary onto the show so that we can all hear about how to make the world a better place. And God damn it, things have got to get better. Links, campaign info, how to get in touch, all that jazz is in the show notes. I love you guys. Thank you so much for listening. And for now, just give yourself a little permission to take a moment away from all the chaos in the world and enjoy doing nothing at all. And when you're ready, maybe even let your imagination run wild and ask yourself, if I rule the world, what would I do?